man don't need no introduction, but it's my duty to introduce our speaker for tonight, which most of you know, and those that don't, you'll get acquainted tonight. So I give to you now Chuck C.
Thank you. I am Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for coming. This is the 15th birthday, more or less, according to our leader.
I think that's beautiful, more or less.
I don't know when my birthday is. It's sometime around the middle, before the last of January, but I don't know when. I don't really know within 10 days of when I got here. And it's not that important to me. Many people say, but you got to have a birthday. I says, why? January is just as good for a birthday to me as anything else. What's the difference whether it's this day or that? And particularly if you haven't had a drink or a pill for 31 years, it don't make much difference, does it? One or two days this way or that way. And particularly if you've been living one day at a time for 31 years. I never worked for a birthday since I got here. I never even worked for next Tuesday. People like you, drunks who were not drunk, told me the first night I got here, this is the day we don't drink. Now that's a sneaky way to keep us coming back. This is the day we don't drink, they said. Now if a day's too long, how long can you live without a drink? Can you live an hour? Make that the length of your life. And then do it again. But said they don't drink today. And they ended up by saying, regardless of how long you live in Alcoholics Anonymous, never expand that time more than 24 hours. And that's the second greatest lesson I ever learned, because I bought it right there and I've kept it. This is my day. I have no past. I want no future. And life is very, very simple if we learn to live it one day at a time. You can't even starve to death in 24 hours if you try. So it's pretty simple to live one day at a time. You got an old boy sitting over here in the front row that has a birthday coming up pretty quick. 31 years. He and I were sweating it out pretty much together at the old North Hollywood group. And I suspect that those of you that know him know that it's almost as hard to get him to quit talking as it is to get me to quit talking. It's old Clyde over here. Now, just to show you what a bad beginning I had with him. He used to get up every Tuesday at the North Hollywood meeting and sit down without saying a thing. He couldn't get his mouth open. And he kept that up for a while, and one Tuesday he got up and he says, goddammit to hell, ladies and gentlemen, he says, I'm going to keep getting up here until I can at least say my goddamn name. And he sat down. That was his first talk in AA. And now you can't hardly shoot him down when he gets up here. But he has something to say. He's been with us for 31 years and he's been doing a good job. I think that my life is better that I've known old Clyde for the whole time he's been around. You know, and faking of the age of the group. It reminds me that that doesn't make too much difference either. Just as long as there's been a group meeting here for a long time. Because if we remember our primary purpose, and if we come here for our primary purpose, the group will prosper. It can't help us. We are in only one business in Alcoholics Anonymous, just one. And that's to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. That's the only thing we can do officially as a society. Now, individual members of Alcoholics Anonymous have no restraints as long as they live according to or within the framework of the 12 traditions. Personally, I talk with many other societies that use our program with our permission. For instance, they're probably members of Emotional Health here tonight, of Gamblers Anonymous here tonight, of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen here tonight, of Fatties Anonymous, some of these days somebody's going to throw a chair at me. But I just can't call them away. I like to call them Fatties Anonymous. We have lots of people who are using our program with our permission. And it's good. Because in the 31 years that I have been with people like you, I have come to believe that there are many kinds of problems, but there is only one answer. I do not believe there's one answer for me, a tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot drunk, and another one for you, a non-alcoholic. You don't believe that? I think the problems are a little bit different, but the answers are the same. For instance, many of you know my good wife. She is a member of Al-Anon. She went with me to meetings for 5 years before Al-Anon was born. And when Lois came out, Bill's wife from New York, and talked about forming a society for the non-alcoholic members of the alcoholic family, Mrs. C. started meeting in our living room in Beverly Hills. We lived in Beverly at the time. And she started a meeting out there, and it lasted. It's still going, as a matter of fact. But after maybe 2 or 3 years or so, it grew out of the living room, and they had to get a hall. And as I say, it's still going. Now, when I was 11 years sober, we moved to Laguna Beach. And there was no Al-Anon in Laguna Beach. She knew one or two members of Alcoholics Anonymous through me down there. But she had no program down there. And my business was in Los Angeles. And I couldn't go to get her, take her to meetings with me, as I did when we lived in Beverly Hills. And I couldn't spend too much time with her, because I was going from my office at 40th and Alameda to meetings where I was yakking, and to 12-step Paul, where I had to go. And she was left alone a great deal. And she went to hell in a basket. She became almost a basket case, really. Now, she had been going to AA meetings with me for 5 years and Al-Anon meetings that she had started for 6. I was 11 years sober when we moved down the beach. And she started working on me to spend a little more time with her, cut down on my time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw her discomfort and I tried. And I lasted from February to Thanksgiving. And Thanksgiving Day, we had the family down there. The kids were there for dinner, and we had dinner, and everything was going pretty good. And after dinner, we moved into the living room, and I said, I got an announcement to make. I have been trying to change my way of life to conform with family, which I'd like to do. But I cannot do it. I'm either going to have to quit all my work in Alcoholics Anonymous, or I've got to do as much of it as I can. Because there's no way that I can make a decision that I'll go talk for this guy and not go talk for that. I can't do it. There'll be a drunk in either place. You know, so how am I going to do it? I can't. And as tough as it is for me to say this, I've got to tell you that I'm going to go when the phone rings. And to Mrs. C, I said, if you don't like it, get yourself another husband. And to the kids, I said, if you don't like it, get yourself another father. And of course, that really finished it up. She thought that was awful. And our son Richard finally gave her the clue. He says, Mother, why don't you start another Al-Anon meeting? Another Al-Anon group. And she started one in the living room. Again. In Laguna Beach. 20 years ago. So, this time, she started it for herself, out of her own need. The first time, she started to help you poor people. You know. Because she'd been going with me to meeting, and she knew all the words. You know. She had heard the AA meetings for 5 years. You see? And so she did that to help the ladies in Beverly Hills who hadn't had her good fortune. But this time, she started the group because she was dying. And she found her answer. She found her answer just as I found mine. Now, this is what I'm talking about. There are many, many problems. But the answer is the same. The greatest good fortune that you and I have as alcoholics is that the formula for sobriety and the formula for the good life and the formula for self-discovery is all the same formula. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, inclusive. Now, if you and I honestly apply the 12 steps to us for sobriety and nothing else, nothing else, all these good things will happen to us. Because the same formula for sobriety and for the good life and for self-discovery is the 12 steps. I think that our greatest difficulty is that we get off on tangents. We allow our related disorders to take a prominent place. You know. Like getting sober so you can get your wife back. Or getting sober so you can get your job back. Or getting sober so you can get your health back. Or the love of your kids. Or something. Now all those problems I had related disorders running out of my ears. My good wife was divorcing me after 20 years. And I might quickly say, without cause. Our kids wouldn't even come home when I was around. And that's not a good way to treat your poor old dad. Really. I think those are two good related disorders. Two of the best. My boss man had sent word to the house that if I ever stepped foot in the plant again, he was going to throw me through the window. And the window to which he referred don't open. There's several people in this room that have seen it. Now, I think that's a related disorder. You know? No home, no job, no health, no sanity, and no money. Now, those are related disorders, I believe. And I never spent 5 seconds on any one of them or all of them put together. I came here for one purpose and one purpose only. And that was to learn how to be sober today so I could rub out as much of the record as I could before I died. Now, that's the only reason I came. I did not even want sobriety for myself. I wanted nothing for me. I had totally and completely accepted the fact that everything dear to me in life was gone and should be gone. And that I was not entitled to have it back. But I didn't want the wife and the kids to remember me as nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. I must rub out as much of the record as I could before it kicked off. I had also accepted death. Because on my next to the last trip out, I spilled over on my face in the floor in the kitchen. Mrs. C. and Dick were sitting in the living room, this is in Beverly Hills. And I was coming off of my next to last drunk, so I went out to the kitchen to get a glass of buttermilk. Buttermilk was my tonic. It stayed down better than anything else. So, Miss C and Dick were sitting in the living room, and they heard me let out a beller and heard me hit the floor. And they came running out, figuring that I was going to be in an alcoholic convulsion, which was my wont. But I had already run out of my convulsions. I didn't have any left. And I was lying there on the kitchen floor as peaceful as anybody you ever looked at. I wasn't doing nothing. They tell me I was a peculiar color. I was blue. And they couldn't wake me up. So they called the oxygen squad from Beverly Hills Receiving Hospital to come down and see if they could do anything with me. And I have reason to believe that they brought me around. I remember what happened after I came to. There was a young doctor with him. And he told me, he says, to all intents and purposes, you were dead. He says, we've had a hell of a time bringing you to. Nobody will ever bring you to again under those circumstances. And then he gave me the finest piece of counsel that I've ever heard or ever hoped to hear. He looked me right in the eye and he said, if I were you, I wouldn't do that anymore. Now I want to pass that on to you new people tonight. If I were you, I wouldn't do that anymore. But I do it again. And my last time was worse than the next to the last time, so I knew I was going to die. And that was all right. But I didn't want to die with the record. Now, one of the things that many of you in this room will not believe, both men and women who have lived with alcoholic mates, will not believe that many of us who were alcoholic as you can get never got to the point where we didn't love our wives and our kids. But it don't appear that way. For instance, I presume that my wife has told me 500 times, Chuck, if you loved this, you wouldn't do these things. You know? And it appears that that's right. But that isn't right. Because some of the worst drunks that I ever got on was because I knew I was crucifying my wife and my kids. And there was nothing I could do about it. Nothing. Now, I was a periodic for the last 10 years I drank because I was going to beat this rap. And I was physically as sober as them tonight between every two drunks for 10 years. And on many occasions during that last 10 years, knowing what I was doing to that family of mine, I would go to bed and my bed was just that far from my wife's. Just that far. But it might as well have been in Siberia, you know? And I would go to bed and I would lie there until I could tell by her breathing that she was asleep. And then I'd cry me up a river. I wanted to take her in my arms and say, look, honey, I love you. I'll never do this again as long as I live, so help me. But I couldn't. I'd already done it 100 times, you know. So there was nothing left to do but just cry up a river, and I'd cry that till of mine full of water because I didn't know what to do. So I never got to the point where I didn't love my wife and my kids. And on the morning that I came to after my last night, the only reason that I wanted sobriety because I knew I was going to die was so that I could rub out as much of the record as I could before the Grim Reaper took me away. Now, I can stand here and tell you tonight that the greatest single event that's ever happened to me in 75 years of life was when the bottle killed me in January 1946. That's the greatest single event that ever happened, or ever will happen, to me. Because had I had to consciously surrender the first time, I would have died without coming to this program. There wasn't any way under heaven that I could consciously surrender. I was 43 years old, and I had never one time admitted defeat in 43 years. not to God, man, woman, or the devil. I had been conditioned for generations to believe that surrender was for the weak. The strong man wins, the weak man surrenders. And the word wasn't even in my vocabulary. So thank God, the bottle killed me on my last trip out. Everything that was between me and me was burned out by the liquor in my last trip out, which was a 4 weeks blackout. Lying in bed drinking the clock around. Every time I opened my eyes, I drank. And that's all I did. It was just empty bottles for 4 weeks. I don't remember anything about it at all. The only thing I remember is it started on the Friday before Christmas, 1945. And the first thing that I remember after that was the 15th or 16th or 17th of January, something like that. And of course, this is awfully hard to believe also, because I had nothing in this carcass of mine but whiskey. I never ate when I drank. And I was full of nothing but whiskey. And yet I came to with the clearest head I've ever known in my entire life, before or since. And that seems to be impossible too, doesn't it? And I saw me as I was. And I saw the circumstances around me as they were. And I accepted the whole business as it was. Remembered that Mrs. C. had found the article in the Saturday Evening Post 5 years before, March 1941, and had read it, and had thought, well, this would be good if I can get the old boy to read it. And so she put it on the left arm of the chair I sit in right now. Open at the right place. And when I came in, I saw it and I read it. And this morning, 5 years later, I remembered that I'd read the article. And I remembered only two things about it: that drunks helped drunks and didn't drink. And they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA. And immediately the curtain dropped. The sanity was gone. I was sickened to death, drunk, and insane. And I had a lot of dying to do. But from the very moment of commitment to me until right now, I have never had a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill. Such is the great significance of this thing called surrender. Surrender. I would rather be able to explain surrender to one audience than to be president of the world. But it cannot be done. There is no way that anybody can tell you the freedom that comes with not wanting anything at all for yourself, which happens in surrender. There's no way that anybody can explain that to another. The only thing we can say about it is that for the alcoholic, surrender is victory. Very likely there is no such thing as peace of mind and serenity of purpose, as long as it's necessary for you and I to try to satisfy the human ego. Because it cannot be done. It is divinely impossible. Because ego is me against the world. It's duality. And duality is the problem. And unity is the answer. It's as simple as that. Now, how we got so far lost, I can't imagine, because all the great mystics of all times have known this and so announced it. The carpenter man, whose birthday we celebrated a couple of months ago, he said it. He said, I am the Father, and he and me and I knew. Now, that's pretty close. That's pretty close, isn't it? He said, the Father and I are one. One, not two. One. That you had to earn, that you had to be worthy of, that you had to merit the grace of God. Now, another thing about me that I'm crabbing a little about. Half of that family of mine was hard-shell Baptist, and the other half was Methodist Church South. That which there's nothing witcher. Now, I'm not against them, but I don't think they had the dope as the way it is. Because if we had had to earn, be worthy of, merit God's grace, we would not have Alcoholics Anonymous. Those of you who have read our history know that when Abby came to call on Bill, because Abby had a temporary sober period, lasted maybe 18 months. And during that time, he called on Bill, because he'd done some drinking with Bill. Bill was our founder. And Bill listened to him talk until he started talking about God and the power greater than himself. He had found sobriety in the Oxford movement. And they had a God of their very own, and a lot of the things that we stole from them when we left them. And Abby was talking to Bill about this power greater than himself. That's one of the principles that they had that helped him get sober. Well, when he started talking about God, old Bill turned off his hearing aid. And went ahead drinking gin. Everyone drank with him, so he had a little more to drink himself. You see? Because right then, gin came tough for Bill. Because Lois was working in Macy's basement. And Bill wasn't working at all. So he turns off his hearing aid and drinks gin until he lands back in Doc Silkworth's booby hatch for drunks. Town hospital in New York. And he was in bad shape. Awful bad. And Doc Silkworth was telling Bill's wife, Lois, that the best thing she could do was to be as nice to him as she could. Because within 6 months, she was either going to have to bury him or lock him up forever. He was a hopeless case. Now, that isn't good news when you're feeling good. That old Bill was coming off a drunk. And that was not good news. And he lay there on his cot thinking about that for a little while. And then he said to himself, he said, I've done everything that anybody ever told me to do, but one. Maybe there was something to what Abby was talking about. And in total and complete abandonment of self, he said, God, if there be a God, reveal yourself to me now. Just like that it happened to Bill. Just like that. And we got Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, if he'd had to earn anything, he couldn't have done it. He didn't have time. There was no earning. But it happened. If I'd had to earn anything, I'd have died 31 years ago. So, that was just as wrong as the first thing they told me. I had to live 55 years to learn that the very word grace means a free gift. That's what the word means. Look in your dictionary when you get home. The grace of God, a free gift. Now, you and I can't earn a free gift, can you? You can't earn a free gift. A free gift's free. So that was backwards. And the next thing that was beaten into me that's just as wrong as the first two was that the two great needs of the individual were to be needed and to be loved. Every one of you that took simple psychology was taught that years ago. The two great needs of the individual are to be needed and to be loved. Backwards. The two great needs of the individual are to love and to do. Love is a complete thing within itself. To love and to do. If you love something or somebody, you do something for them. And it makes you feel good. Don't make any difference what happens out there. It's loving and doing. Some of you know the guy I'm going to mention. He's a doctor. And he was my wife's doctor for a number of years. He's also drunk. And a member of our society. And he called me at midnight one night, about 2 or 3 years ago. And he says, "Chuck, what's your definition of love?" And I said, "You damn fool, it's the same at 10 o'clock in the morning as it is 12 midnight." I said, "Hang up the phone and call me tomorrow, 10 o'clock. He says, "Chuck, what's your definition of love?" I said, "You won't like it." "Well," he says, "what is it?" I said, "Action." "What?" he said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Action. If you love somebody or something, you do something for them. And that's the secret of the whole deal. It's an inside job, just like everything else. It's the doing something that makes you feel good." So everything that they taught me as a child has had to be reversed in the last 31 years. And it's all reversed. And it's good. It's good. So, I am convinced that anybody with any problem who would honestly apply the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous to his daily life one day at a time, we'll find the answer to his living problem. And alcoholism is a living problem. I got to tell you one more little dealie before I talk a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous. Better. That's why you came, wasn't it? There was a guy whom I am sorry I didn't meet, and I could have, because he died after I got sober. His name was Dr. Carl Jung. In my opinion, and don't make any difference, my opinion, because I'm not smart enough to make it mean anything, but as far as I'm able to perceive, he was the greatest psychological mind that the world's ever produced up until now. I love him like nobody's business. And prior to the birth of Alcoholics Anonymous, Dr. Jung was working with a guy by the name of Roland. And Roland, every time he came back to see the good doctor, was worse, you know. And eventually, he was back, and he was in bad condition. And Dr. Jung said to him, Roland, medical science has done everything in its power for you, and it can do no more. Psychiatry has done everything in its power for you, and it can do no more. And it's now my duty to tell you that the only possibility for a person of your ilk is a spiritual awakening. A spiritual awakening. The only possibility. Now, that was prior to Bill's experience in the hospital. And after that experience, and after he, Bill, and Dr. Bob, and some of the rest of them, had worked this program out, and had proven that it works if we work it. Now, I want to say that again. They proved that it works if we work it. And they wrote it down and gave it to us, you know. And it was going along pretty good. And Bill heard about Roland and Dr. Jung. Dr. Jung at that time lived in Zurich, Switzerland. And Bill wrote him a letter. And he said to him that he had been he'd have been apprised of the fact that Roland had come to him and been his patient. And what he told Roland that had happened to him. And Bill wanted to know how come he knew enough to make that prognosis. Boy, I should be a psychiatrist, shouldn't I? Is that a good word? Prognosis? What does it mean, son? Dr. Jung wrote back. Now, these are not his exact words, but this is the sense of what he told Bill. He said that he had always known that the problem behind the bottle for an alcoholic was his search for unity. His search for unity. And he couldn't find it. And when he found the bottle, it was the nearest thing to unity he'd ever known. And he latched onto it. And it wasn't a problem, it was an answer. Now, if that isn't my story, I'll put up with it. That was my story. My search for unity. And he even quoted one of my favorite verses in the Holy Writ. As the heart, H-A-R-T, meaning dear, of course. As the heart panteth after the water brook, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. That was in Dr. Jung's letter to Bill. Now, unity was what happened to me when I had my first drink. I never had a drink until I was 19. And the first drink I ever took was an answer, not a problem. It was an answer. It allowed me to live in my own world and took the rough edges off of yours. It made it a little bit easier for me to live with you bums. You know? Now, the very fact that liquor was an answer to me proves to me without question of doubt that the problem was already here. The booze wasn't the problem. I was the problem. I could not integrate myself into the life around me. And I couldn't find the answer. I had another little thing that was bad, but good. Because before the age of reason, my insides rejected a lot of the stuff that they tried to tell me in the religions of my family. Now, I've got nothing against it. But it didn't work for me because my insides rejected it. For instance, they told me as a kid that God would take my kids away from me to punish me for my sins. Now, my insides would not accept that, and they don't now. They do not now accept it. I got hurt in football. And they were going to cut off my right leg. And I will never forget my family sitting around the bed and my old granddaddy, my mother's father, with a beard clear down to his navel. White beard. He rolled his thumbs a lot. And that's the one thing I got from him. I rolled my thumbs. I sit and roll my thumbs, you know. And here's my old granddaddy telling me that God's punishing me for playing a game that people bet on. You know, isn't that awful? I'm dying. And he's telling me God's punishing me for playing a game. And they're going to cut my leg off. That's why I came to California in 1922. Because they were going to cut my leg off right up to my hip. You know? Now, I did not believe that God was punishing me for playing a game that people bet on. And when my granddaddy wasn't on guard, I would say to him, Paul, one of my grandfathers was grandfather and the other one was Paul, so we knew the difference between them, you know. I said, Paul, as I understand it, you were a broad jumper with great ability. And he'd light up, you know. Yes, he could out jump them all. And when I got him really telling me about his jumping, I'd say, Paul, did anybody ever bet when you were jumping? You know? And he'd retreat. But he wouldn't admit that he was wrong. But anyhow, this is the step I'm talking about. My inside rejected it. And they still reject it. So, again, conscious separation. The best definition that you and I will ever hear of the human ego is the feeling of conscious separation from. I walked alone for 43 years of life. Now, if there was ever a bunch of people on the face of the earth that wanted to be a part of life, it's us folks. Right? We wanted so much to be a part of life. And we're always apart from. In my last years, I was a lone drinker, really. I was a bottle drinker. But every once in a while, I'd be so... It was so necessary for me to become a part of that I'd go down to the bright lights. And what'd I do? Start a nice conversation with somebody? No, I went to the last stool in the bar. Sit down and get me a double. And if anybody came along and spoke to me, I'd hit him right in the mouth. And I went down there to be a part of. He disturbed my reverie. My solitude. Now, it's not normal for us to walk alone. It's normal for us to walk down the high road of life like we walk now, with our arms around each other, sharing our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. This is just as normal as breathing. And this is AA. This is our deal. It's not normal to be away from home. It's normal to become as little kids, totally dependent on this great thing called God. We're like kids that are lost in the woods. We're away from home. And the only thing that separates us is conscious separation. Because we can't be separated. We can't be separated. The thing that you and I have looked for forever, we cannot escape. We can't escape. If the first two words of the Lord's Prayer mean what they say. Remember when they said the carpenter master teaches to pray? He said, after this manner pray ye, our Father, his Father, your Father, and mine. Now, if that's true, you can let your imagination go absolutely crazy, and you can't even get close to the truth of being itself. God, my Father, I, his kid. This is fantastic. And that's the way it is. Conscious separation is the only roadblock there is. Now, our program, as far as I am able to perceive, and I've lived in it, with it, and of it for 31 years, our program is nothing in the world but uncovering, discovering, and discarding. That's the program. Uncovering, discovering, and discarding. And every bit of it's an inside job. Every bit of it's an inside job. Uncovering, discovering, and discarding. We uncover the thing we've been looking for all our lives, and that's the first 9 steps of our program. They're clearing away the wreckage of the past. Uncovering the thing we've been looking for all our lives. Then with Brother Lawrence and some of the rest of his people, we can look deep within ourselves and find us, which includes our relationship to each other and to God. It's fantastic. Now, I'm going to be 2 minutes over. And you what? He said it wouldn't be the first time. I would give him a little hell for that, but he came as far as I did tonight because I came up from the desert myself, and so did he. So I won't argue with him.
You just keep talking.
Okay. Uncovering, discovering, and discarding. It was my happy privilege to know Father Ed Dowling very, very well. Those of you who have read AA Comes of Age will remember that Father Ed was not an alcoholic. He was a Jesuit priest. He published Queen's Works in St. Louis, Missouri. And he heard about our program in its infancy, went to New York to find out about it. And he fell in love with it and was not one of us, but was with us until he died in 1960. And I happen to know him good, and I spent a lot of time with him, although I am not Catholic. And on this particular occasion, we were talking, and Father Ed said to me, "Chuck," he said, "your cross was alcoholism." He says, "My cross was lack of faith." He says, "I went to school 18 years and was ordained a Jesuit priest, and I didn't believe nothing." Now, I can imagine that that was a tremendous cross to bear, can't you? Here he's supposed to be a jetty, and there they're just about the tops. And he don't believe nothing. You know. Now he says, "That was my cross. Your cross was alcoholism." "Now," says he, "I came to believe," and I want you to listen to this, "I came to believe, watching what happens to you people in Alcoholics Anonymous." Well, that's one of the most beautiful things I can imagine. Isn't that beautiful? Here's a Debbie priest. "I came to believe, watching what happens to you people in Alcoholics Anonymous." Beautiful, isn't it? And sometime later, I talked in St. Louis at the annual meeting back, at the annual dinner back there, and Father Ed was there, and he went to coffee with Miss C and I after the thing was over. And we slid into the booth for coffee, and he started plying me with questions. And I'd been talking all evening. And I'd say every 15 minutes, I'd say, "Father, talk. I love to hear you talk. Talk. Let me listen a while." So he'd ask another question. And the last question he asked, he says, "Chuck, tell me about the family." And I said, "No, Father, I won't. Miss C's sitting here. She'll tell you about the family." And she did. And the good father had a habit, to those of you that might have known him. He'd purse up his little old mouth like a rosebud and look off into the distance for seemingly forever. Probably a half a minute, but it just seemed like forever, you know. And he turned to me and he said, "You know something, Chuck?" And I said, "What, Father?" He says, "Sometimes I have to believe that heaven is just a new pair of glasses." Now, I pretty near fell out of the booth. This from a Jebby priest, you know. And I said to Mrs. C, "Where's the difference? Where's the difference?" Now, that's exactly what this program is for me. It's a new vision. A new motivation. And a new action pattern. And it is the difference between hell and heaven. In other words, self-discovery includes a feeling of dignity, of value, of worth that is unspeakably beautiful. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the human ego, but it has everything to do with gratitude. "I'm so grateful I can't see. I'm so grateful I can't see. Every day I live, I'm more grateful. Because I've had over 11,350 days that I would not have had were it not for people like you, this program, and the God that I found with you people." It's fantastic. Now, a lot of people are born and die and never live 31 years. And I've got 31 years of velvet. 31 years that I wouldn't have had but for people like you. This program and my very own God. Now my gratitude comes in that order. And I'm not ashamed of it a bit. I don't think I'm at all ungrateful when I say that my gratitude starts with you. because you are people just like you. Drunks who were not drunk are the people that took me on their laps and rocked me to sleep when my own family wouldn't spit on me. So my gratitude starts with you, then with the program, and then with God. But that ain't so bad when you come to see that God is you, and God is the program, and God is